want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. I declare that this one is a blockbuster. A very important conversation. I can't remember where I was on the night of June 9th, 2006, but Joe Hickman can't forget. He was on guard duty at Guantanamo, and he saw a white van make three trips, hauling individual prisoners out of the main camp to what he now knows was a CIA black site. Those three men came back dead, but the prison camp officials describe their deaths as suicides. Joe Hickman doesn't buy it, and he's just published a book called Murder at Camp Delta. And in addition to his recap of the events of June 9th, 2006, Joe Hickman helped expose the medical experimentation that goes on at Guantanamo, where every prisoner was dosed with an anti-malaria drug that was known to have psychotic side effects at the high levels it was administered in. And Joe Hickman also learned that some people in high rank referred to Guantanamo as America's battle lab. And when you connect that with the medical experiments being conducted on prisoners, and the fact that three men died and it was claimed suicide, then Guantanamo is a death camp where human medical experiments have been conducted. And if that ain't hell, it doesn't exist. This program is made possible by your support through your subscriptions. My thanks today to Steve Wozenski, Jeff Lipinski, who just re-upped. Michael Powell just renewed his annual subscription. And Faith Peoples has more than one subscription. Thank you, one and all. If you're not yet a subscriber, come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click the sign-up link under my picture, and you can follow the directions there. Our best deal is the $50 annual subscription, and I've got a bonus for new annual subscribers. You get an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's Empire of Chaos, and Guantanamo, unfortunate part of that empire of chaos. Today's podcast is dedicated to Shaker Amer, the last British man held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Never charged, 6 years cleared. And the case of Shaker Amer fits into the bizarre, compelling, tragic story of Murder at Camp Delta. This is a new book by Joseph Hickman, subtitled A Staff Sergeant's Pursuit of the Truth About Guantanamo Bay. Joe Hickman joins us today for our in-depth interview. Joe, thank you very much for a very important book and for having the courage to tell your story.
Oh, thank you, and I'm happy to be on your show.
And we're going to return to the case of Shocker Ammer, because in the events of that night in June of 2006, your book reveals something about what happened to Shocker Ammer consistent with the three men who reportedly committed suicide that night at Guantanamo Bay. And, Joe, before we get into your story, which I first learned about from Scott Horton and from the great reporting of our mutual friend Jason Leopold, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about yourself and why you wound up spending a year on duty at Guantanamo.
Well, when I went to Guantanamo, I had 14 years in the military. I was a sergeant, and I was picked for this duty. It was a random pick the military does. They call a unit up to become guards in Guantanamo. So my unit's number came up, and we were picked for a one-year tour from March 2006 to March 2007
mm-hmm.
to serve there as guards.
And what was your impression? Because by that time, the framework had been clearly established that the men who went to Guantanamo were the worst of the worst, the most dangerous terrorists on the planet, who had to be held there to keep America safe.
Yes, and that's what I thought while I was getting trained up for that mission. I totally drank the Kool-Aid that they were offering. It was, we were told if we ever turn our backs on any of these detainees, they would kill us. They are absolutely the worst of the worst terrorists on the planet, as they would say.
Mm-hmm. And Joe, by 2006, most Americans knew of the grisly photos from Abu Ghraib. We knew something about the black sites. They had just transferred the so-called high-value detainees from the CIA secret prisons over to Guantanamo. And, many of us knew about the torture programs that were approved personally by Donald Rumsfeld. And so I'm curious how much you knew about the dark side of Guantanamo, and if you had any misgivings about being assigned to guard duty there.
Well, the high-value detainees were transported over in September of 2006. That was during my time there.
Mm-hmm.
When I first arrived, they were still in their black sites, CIA black sites.
Good point.
When I first heard I was going there, and I knew that there was a mission, I knew about Abu Ghraib, I knew about the torture program, I really believed at the time that warfare has changed so drastically, so quickly for the U.S., we had to come up with an unconventional way of treating these detainees. I thought it was legitimate. I thought that we were still following, I guess, the spirit of the Geneva Convention. We were still, that's what I believed before I went there, that we were still, they didn't qualify for Geneva Convention, they didn't qualify under the Geneva Convention, but I thought we would still uphold those types of, that type of holding. I thought we would mm-hmm. still be treating them pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And tell me a little bit about your unit and the extent to which you really had a strong bond and a shared sense of mission. And how did that hold up under the day-to-day drumbeat of duties at Gitmo?
Well, my unit was very close. We were all extremely close. My squad, I'm talking about 10 men that I constantly serve with every day,
mm-hmm.
12 hours a day. We hardly had any time off, so we got very close. We were brothers, and the breakdown as far as our mission and questioning our mission happened on day one. As soon as we arrived at Guantanamo, I should say a few days after arriving at Guantanamo, when we actually saw our first detainees being held there.
Mm-hmm. And describe that, Joe. Tell us about it.
Well, I went into a tower that overlooked Camp 2-3 inside of Camp Delta, and immediately the first thing that hits you is the odor that comes out of the camp. It is terrible body odor coming out. It's under the Cuban sun. These detainees are only allowed 2 showers a week, and they're sitting in 6x8 cells. And they've been, and I realized when I was in the tower, these guys have been in these 6x8 cells for years by the time I arrived. And you see them pacing back and forth. And then they're allowed only 1 hour of rec time a week, which they would transfer them out of their 6x8 cells, put them in a 12x12 fenced-in area.
Wow.
And they would just walk in circles. It was exactly how you see animals act in a zoo.
Mm-hmm.
Just the pacing back and forth in their cells. And it was, you know, you'd hear them wake up from nightmares and cry, and you'd hear the guards agitating the detainees, and the detainees agitating the guards because of, I think, more or less boredom on both sides, and the irritation of the heat, because the cells have, you're in 90-degree weather, and you're in a cells that are not temperature controlled with tin roofs, so you're baking inside, basically. And then when night would fall, Guantanamo's infested with rats. You would hear the rats underneath the cells trying to scrape their way into the cells to find any leftover food or anything like that. Sitting in the tower that first day, I couldn't watch the whole time. I had to just duck down in my tower and try to soak this in. It was overwhelming. And unfortunately, as time went on, I became desensitized from that. But it was right away we realized the spirit of the Geneva Convention certainly wasn't being followed.
Mm-hmm.
And
your description of the rats, I've heard about this phenomenon before, but the rats actually have more freedom than the humans who are caged at Guantanamo.
Oh, absolutely. It was really, I found it interesting when we first arrived and we went into a briefing. We were told automatically that the iguanas, there's iguanas all over Guantanamo as well, that if we killed an iguana, we would be charged $10,000 fine, 45 days restriction, 45 days loss of pay. But if it was no justification to kill an iguana, but there was, you know, it's okay. You can justify killing a detainee, but you never kill an iguana because they're endangered.
Wow, that's really twisted. Now, Joe, you helpfully included a map of the American facilities at Guantanamo in the first pages of your book, and I wonder if you could thumbnail for our listeners, in simple terms, the composition of Camp Delta, because there are three or four distinct areas there, and this becomes important as we explain to people the events of June 9th, 2006.
Sure. I hope I don't get in trouble for that map.
Well, you're not in the service anymore, and they don't have any way of punishing you or getting back at you, do they?
Well, I think they can punish anyone. As we've seen with John Kerouac, they can punish anyone and get back at anyone for anything.
Yeah.
I'm always a little nervous, but
okay. Well, go ahead. Describe this for us, please.
Sure. It's Camp America holds all the detainee holding facilities in Guantanamo Bay. So inside of Camp America, you have Camp Delta.
Mm-hmm.
You have Camp 5, Camp 6, and Camp Echo. Well, Camp 5 and Camp Echo. Camp 6 was being built when I was there. It wasn't absolutely finished yet.
Mm-hmm.
You have entrance points and exits inside of Camp America that leads to all the detainee holding facilities. Camp Delta has four camps inside of it, Camps 1, 2, 3, and 4. Four is a compliant facility where detainees can live and have communal living. That's the only one. That one, two, and three are maximum security,
mm-hmm.
where they're in 6-byte cells.
And so Camp 4, you know, in comparative terms, is the club fed with tennis courts, golf, and massage on call?
Well, it's, I wouldn't go that far. It is communal living, 10 men per room. They have a basketball court, soccer field. It's a lot less restrictions
mm-hmm.
there. And the only ones that go there is the ones that are... that they consider compliant in interrogations.
All right. And it's important to note that there is a guard tower, which is, as I'm looking at this map, at the rear of Camp Delta, which leads to the larger open space of Camp America. And that guard tower becomes significant as part of your account of the events of June 9th. Tell us what you knew at the time about the areas beyond Camp Delta and even beyond Camp America, and most importantly, the CIA black site, which came to be known as Camp No.
Well, I didn't know much about the black site at all. What happened was I was on patrol one day, and it was extremely hot. Couple weeks after we arrived, and I was looking for a place where I could give my men a break and rest. We were on a mobile patrol. We were in a Humvee, so I was looking for a shaded area to park the Humvee. And we went into the brush a little bit outside of Camp America, and we found a fence that had all these signs on it: no photographs, no trespassing, a lot of things you couldn't do. And me and another soldier became curious, what's behind this fence? So we started walking the fence line, and we could see inside the fence line was a facility, and it was obvious to us that it was built the same way as Delta or Camp 5. It was the same type of construction materials used. It was no doubt in our mind, as soon as we saw this place, it was some sort of detainee holding facility, some, you know, built by KBR.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the way it was structured and the way it appeared. And I'll never forget my guard that I was with when we found this. He said to me, do you know what we just found? And I just was curious to what he would say. So I said, what do you think it is? And he said, we just found our Auschwitz. This isn't on the maps. This isn't nowhere on the books. This isn't supposed to be here. And I said, well, then it's time for us to get out of here.
mm-hmm.
And we took off. We later called it Camp No. It was only, you know, my guys that we nicknamed it that because of all the no photography signs, no trespassing, and no, it's not there, and no, it doesn't exist.
Right, yeah. Now, what kind of scenes did you participate in? In particular, one of the backdrops to the events that left three men dead in June of 2006 was a hunger strike that was underway. And the hunger strikes led to force feeding, and my listeners are quite familiar with this. We've discussed the Diab case with attorney John Eisenberg in great detail. The videotapes of his force feeding and cell extractions are still the subject of litigation and may be released at some point. But talk a little bit about the events leading up to June 9th and the tensions that were building because of hunger strikes, the cell extractions, and also there was a riot.
Yes, the riot was May 18th. We noticed some tension in the camps probably a day or two before the riots. And I'm still to this day not sure what the tensions were stirred up from prior to the riot. But on May 18th, I was on QRF, which is the Quick Reaction Force. I was a non-commissioned officer in charge of that for that day. and we were called to Camp 4, said there was a disturbance there. I had a 10-man team with me. So when we went inside of Camp 4, and QRF is basically the SWAT team that, that crushes any disturbances or anything like that. We're trained to crush any problems they have with uprisings. So when we arrived in Camp 4, we were told it was Whiskey Block that was having the trouble. We went to Whiskey Block, and there were certain procedures we were supposed to follow, but we didn't have time to do our procedures because a Navy guard at the door started yelling, "He's hanging himself, he's hanging himself." And he opened the door, and we were forced to rush into the facility, not knowing how many detainees were inside or what the situation was at all. When we ran in, there was 10 detainees waiting for us, so it was basically 10 on 10 in close quarters. And it was it ended up being a street brawl. Nobody was hanging themselves in there. It was a complete ambush on us, I felt like. So we were in this huge, similar to a barroom brawl, I guess. And we were just really going at it, and then one of my guys fell on the ground, and a detainee had made a shank, and I thought he was going to stab him, and I gave the order to fire on the detainees. I had three men in there, two with shotguns and one with a 40-millimeter rubber ball round we called Evil SpongeBob. It was, if you got hit with it, it was going to be nasty. So I gave the order to fire on the detainees, and they surrendered, and they left. We escorted them out, and the Navy guards that were waiting outside really put a beating on them. And from that day on till June 9th, you could almost cut the tension in the air with a knife. It was just so tense in the camps.
And Joe,
all the detainees were moved out of Camp 4 and put into 1, 2, and 3,
mm-hmm.
which is a big difference for them. And a massive hunger strike started right after that riot. There was over 86 detainees hunger striking all at once.
And again, Shocker Ammer was one of those. We'll talk about him a little bit later in the sequence here. But also, Joe, your order to fire on a detainee, in a curious way, built you up. You became kind of a made man in the Gitmo gang.
Well, yeah, I gave the order to fire. It was my decision. I had a man down. He was hurt. He was looked like he was going to be stabbed, and I had to come up with a quick decision on how to stop this, and I gave the order to fire on the detainees. I was the only one ever to do that. I think someone's did it since in 2010 or 11. But it was, I was really, the repercussions, I knew I thought there would be some repercussions for doing it because I wasn't at lethal range. I was at lethal range, not non-lethal range. You're supposed to be 10 to 12 feet in order to give that order, but I was 5 to 6 feet at most. And then the detainees gave me a nickname for the riot as Satan. And the guards and the detainees from that moment on, when I went to work, I was known as Satan.
Joe, you make a comment in this time frame about the shift in the upper command from General Hood to Rear Admiral Harry Harris. And Harris came in, and he actually changed some policies and hardened the situation. For example, you talk about the way he imposed the playing of the Star Spangled Banner, which appeared to really rile the prisoners. Talk a little bit about the way some of those tensions were elevated by the change in policies at the camp.
Yeah, Harry Harris changed a lot of things from General Hood. General Hood, you never heard the Star-Spangled Banner played in the camp where the detainees were living. Harry Harris hooked up speakers and made sure everybody heard it throughout the camp. And, of course, as soon as that started, some of the young guards, the teenage kids that we had in the Navy and the Army, they would see the detainees just sitting around while the national anthem was playing. They would try to make them stand up and give respect, and it was just totally wrong to try to make them do that. And I think they stopped pretty soon after that. But and then Harris also had another rule.
And Joe, let me just jump in here because I found this quote here while you were talking. You say, "Had I ever been captured by the Russians and held as a POW, I wouldn't have wanted to stand and show my respect to their flag when they played their national anthem. I could understand why the detainees wouldn't want to do the same with ours."
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they knew also, they knew, they had track of time pretty well, and they knew that we would play the national anthem just about the same time as their call to prayer,
mm-hmm.
for their morning prayers. So it was a bad move by Harris to even do that. And then he came up with another rule that if a detainee doesn't follow your order, you give them one more order, and if they don't follow it the second time, then you IRF them, which mm-hmm. means you send a cell extraction team in to make them compliant.
Mm-hmm.
So things started to get very strict real fast, and I don't know why the change. It didn't seem necessary at all. You're making guys that are absolutely miserable and going crazy to even worse than that. I felt like you were really pushing them to the limit.
And here you describe dinner with a friend that you made there who worked in the clinic. And you say that on a given day, while the national anthem played, a prisoner snapped, started beating his head against the wall. And when you were having dinner with Lisa, she asked, "Have you noticed any change in the prisoners?" You say things seem a lot more tense. She says, "We're getting a lot more detainees brought into the clinic with injuries from being IRFed." That's the cell extraction, as you said. "And the IRF teams are working a lot at night. That's when we're getting all these injured detainees." So one of the things here that surfaces is that there was a clampdown even on your communication with, you know, people at Guantanamo, not necessarily members of your own squad. But there were, I guess, rules in place, or maybe just a lot of standards that everybody fell in line behind, not to gossip or talk about the serious problems that you observed.
Yes, everything was very compartmentalized. You never really wanted to. OPSEC was the phrase that everyone used. Everything is operational security. Never speak about the SOPs. Just go there, do your job, follow the SOPs, and go home. That's what you want to do every day to survive Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really drilled into you from the higher-ups all the way down. They know that's what they have to do.
So now let's turn to the events of June 9th, moving over past midnight into the early morning hours of June 10th of 2006. And as you explain in the book, you actually were subbing for the sergeant of the guard, and if he had not come down with a serious headache, you might not have been on duty that night, and the book would never have been written.
That's true. He suffered from cluster headaches, and he needed a break, and I told him I would work that shift for him.
Mm-hmm. All right. So give our listeners a sense of what the duty of the Sergeant of the Guard is and why you became a little suspicious by the movements of a white van.
Well, the duties of Sergeant of the Guard, I was in charge of several posts, some perimeter posts and some posts inside of Camp Delta, including the QRF team as well. So I was in charge of the towers. I was in charge of QRF, I was in charge of the mobile patrol throughout the camps and several observation posts and the entrances and exits inside of Camp Delta and Camp America. So I had to oversee those that night and make sure everybody was doing their job, and it was everything was running smooth. The white van, we called it the paddy wagon, sometimes the pizza van. We had a couple different nicknames for it. But the white van was a detainee transport van. It had a little cell in the back of it. And we were never allowed to... We signed in everybody and inspected every vehicle that came in Camp America. And Camp Delta, we inspected 100% of the vehicles that went in there. But we were never allowed to sign this vehicle in or out of Camp America or Camp Delta, or inspect the vehicle.
Now, did it have special plates? Did it say, you know, this is invisible? Did it say, we're from another agency, which is the code for CIA? Why was this van off limits, and how was that communicated to you?
We were told that when we first started training on the entrance points into Camp America, we were told that by the guards we were relieving. They told us... There was two vehicles that you never sign in or out. They don't want them on the books. And that was the white van, which we called the paddy wagon. It was very distinguished. You could make it out because of the pad box on the back of it and the people riding it. It was very distinguished from any other van there.
Mm-hmm.
And another one was called the Iceman. The Iceman was a four-door sedan. I forget the make and model. I can't remember. But it was a four-door sedan that had a plaque just a written on the front of the window that said ICE. And it was we called him the Iceman. We mm-hmm. never searched his vehicle, signed him in or out or anything.
Now, Joe, this is a fundamental violation of protocol. And I've never served in the military, but my experience is at the maximum security prison out here called San Quentin. And I have visited San Quentin over 100 times, been subjected to all of the search policies and procedures, and they, you know, have advised me of the no hostage policy program. And so I know about the strict routines that detention guards observe. And so to be confronted with this exception, and there are no orders, there's no written order for it, you didn't receive, and contradict me if I'm misstating this, but from the book, you didn't receive any authorization from one of your superiors to give a pass to the Iceman and the pizza van. And so how do these exceptions get built in to a system that is supposed to be so rigorous and you know, built on these routines that can never be varied?
Well, that's I was alarmed when I first went down there. I have a lot of detention experience before I went to Guantanamo. I was a guard for 9 years at Baltimore, in Baltimore, transporting prisoners. From prison to court and different places. So I had a lot of experience. I knew right away, and I had a lot of security experience. I knew right away this was holes in our security. Why would they allow this? And it was unwritten rules passed down by the command we were relieving and the command that we were serving under for the first few weeks made sure we followed those rules. They had officers at the gates and made sure we never did those things. So we knew that this was, for some reason, very important, but I just felt like it really put a hole in what we were doing as far as keeping the place secure.
And Joe, the other thing,
absolutely wrong.
The other thing that surfaces for me is you earlier referenced the kind of compartmentalization. But it was Navy guards who operated the white van, at least on the night of June 9th. And again, you were compartmentalized as an Army guy. You didn't really communicate with the Navy personnel. Is that fairly accurate?
Oh, absolutely. We didn't communicate with anybody except the people that were in our command.
I mean, even in the mess hall, even on recreation breaks, you never, you know, hung out with the Navy guys?
No, and we... And it's easy to do because you don't even know each other's names. No one wears nameplates there. It's the only base I've ever been where you just don't. No one knows your name while you're working.
Wow.
And that makes it harder if you see an abuse. Who are you reporting? You don't even have a name.
Wow. All right. With all of this in mind, let me read a passage here from your book, the chapter entitled June 9, 2006. Staff Sergeant Green let me know that everything was fine, and it appeared to be so, until I saw the white van enter Delta and proceed to Alpha Block. Unlike Navy guards in the cell blocks who used plastic flex cuffs to restrain detainees' wrists, the escorts from the white van used metal police-style cuffs. As I watched them take out the first detainee from Camp 1 Alpha Block that evening and load him in the van, something about metal cuffs on a person being loaded into a windowless metal box bothered me. I watched the van leave, making a right out of Camp Delta and a left onto the road that went to ACP Roosevelt. It was leaving Camp America. I had no doubt that it bothered the guys in the tower that I stayed up there with them. They didn't want the SOG, the Sergeant of the Guard, hanging around breathing down their necks. But as I watched the van return some 20 minutes later and pick up the second detainee from Alpha Block and repeat its route, I became curious. I knew that at this late hour on a Friday night, military commissions, the tribunals for prosecuting the detainees, were not in session. Where could they be going, I thought to myself. I had a suspicion. 20 minutes later, when the van came to pick up a third detainee, before they left Camp Delta, I went to ACP Roosevelt to see where the van was going. If it went straight, it was heading toward the main base, but if it turned left, it was heading toward Camp No. When I arrived at ACP Roosevelt, the men on duty were busy checking IDs and searching vehicles for bombs. I stood there pretending to watch them. When I saw the white van heading toward Roosevelt, I felt anxious. If the van turns toward Camp No, what am I supposed to do? I'm not supposed to know it exists, I thought. As the van passed Roosevelt, I watched it intently, and I felt my heart sink when it went about 100 yards past Roosevelt and turned left toward Camp No. So, and Joe, let me correct something that reading this text just made clear, and that is that it was not actually Navy personnel who were operating the van that night, because if it had been Navy guards, they would have used the flex cuffs. So this tipped you off that it was some other service or agency that was responsible for the van that night. So with this description in mind, tell our listeners just how conflicted you were about observing this and wondering what the hell was going on, especially since you were nominally in charge.
It did bother me a lot. I couldn't figure out for the life of me. I knew Camp No existed. I had in my head, which I never forget my guard saying, "We found our Auschwitz." I'm not supposed to know about the place. We weren't even supposed to be in that area because it's a little outside of Camp America. But I knew something was happening to him, and it was probably going to be really bad to be sent there. I knew that the camp had a lot of tension. I knew there was a hunger strike. And what were they sending three detainees there for? And I just had no one I could report it to. So it was extremely stressful and frustrating.
And what time did those three initial trips of the van out of Camp Delta occur?
Right around the time my shift started. I was around 6 p.m.
Okay. And then at 11:30, you write, "Everything changed. Though I didn't know it at the time, my life in the military would be transformed completely. I was in Tower 1 when the van finally reappeared in Camp Delta. Instead of driving over to Alpha Block, from where the three detainees had been removed, the van backed up to the medical clinic with its rear doors facing the front doors of the clinic. The escorts inside turned off the engine and lights and sat inside for a few minutes. From my vantage above them and about 40 feet distant, I could see one escort, a male, on the passenger side sitting there, turned to the other as if talking. It was unusual for a vehicle to enter at this hour and just sit there with its lights off. After several minutes passed, I saw the driver's side door of the van open. I decided to climb down the tower to better see what was happening. By the time I reached the bottom of the ladder, the back doors of the van were open. I heard voices from the entrance to the medical clinic. It sounded like they were carrying in somebody, but I couldn't see, and I didn't feel comfortable walking up to the clinic and snooping. Instead, I walked to the Sally Port, that's a gate affair, and waited there. I wanted to see the Navy escorts when they drove out, look at them in the eyes. It wasn't quite rational, but since I didn't have the authorization to search the van or question the escorts, I thought maybe I could discern something by looking in their eyes, but I didn't get that chance. The van remained by the clinic with its lights off. After 15 minutes, I walked back to the clinic and got close enough to see that the escorts were not in the van anymore. Its back doors were closed, and there was no activity in the entrance area of the clinic. So you observed them bringing back what you learned a little while later was a dead body.
Yes. When I first went through the when I first saw the van come back, like you said, I was 40 feet away, and I knew right then that something. Why were they going there? And then, I guess around 11:30, quarter to 12, all the lights come on in Camp America. Sirens are going off. Everyone's running towards the medical clinic. And I saw my friend, the Navy corpsman, outside. And I asked her what happened. She was really upset, and she said three detainees killed themselves. They stuffed rags down their throats. I asked her where they came from. Where were they? She said they were in the camp. They were in Camp 1. I went to the tower again and asked my guards, did you see anybody transported from Camp 1 to the medical clinic that night? No one was transported that night. I asked another tower guard that was the one you were talking about in the beginning of the program. It is directly on the walkway of Camp 1 with a clear, unobstructed view of the whole camp. He reports to me no one was transported that night to the medical clinic. I had three guards in Sally Port 1 that had a view of the clinic, and they were 15 meters away at most of the detaining medical clinic. No one was transported to Camp 1. I'm getting the same answer from everybody. So I knew that it just didn't happen. And the only thing that went to that entrance of the detaining medical clinic that night was the paddy wagon.
And Joe, much later in your book, based on the investigation that was conducted by law students at Seton Hall, there was the discovery of a statement given by an unnamed MA3. MA3, tell us what that acronym means.
Master at Arms, Third Class. It's a military police officer, enlisted man.
Mm-hmm. And he filed a statement that got buried in all of the documents, and you describe how the documents were all shuffled to make it harder to, find the actionable information. But he provided this corroboration that there were no people moved from Building 1 to the clinic, Camp 1, on that evening. And so this corroboration is very important, because this is a guy who was sent on an alert to find a detainee who, allegedly was in a bad situation, and discovered that he was already at the clinic. And so this further, clarifies that the only three men who died were the three men who got a ride in the white van out of the camp and returned dead just before midnight.
Yes, and several other things that he said in his sworn statement was that the detainees, when he saw them, they were taking cuffs off the detainees and wrapping their arms in cloths, their arms and legs. So that was very important later on as well.
Mm-hmm.
He gave a completely different story, and that document was not only shuffled, it was purposely misplaced as an exhibit. The Seton Hall team were able to prove that document was not in an exhibit where it was supposed to be and replaced with another document.
So, Joe, next, at the end of your shift at 7 a.m., you gathered your guys and a meeting was called starting at approximately 7:30, presided over by Colonel Bumgarner. And you described him as stumbling and nervous, which was out of character for him. What was the bizarre message that Colonel Bumgarner imparted to you and your colleagues?
Colonel Bumgarner stood in front of all of us that were on duty that night, and he said, "You know, three detainees died last night. You know they stuffed rags down their throats, but you're going to hear something different on the news." He said, "You're going to hear a lot of rumors. We just want you to not say anything to anyone. Don't tell your families. Don't discuss this what happened with your families or the media or anyone else." He gave us a direct order not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
He reminded us that we were being monitored, our communications equipment, our phones, internet, email was being monitored by the NSA, and we were not to say anything to anyone.
And what he described to you, you already knew to be a lie.
Well, yeah, I knew that that's what my corpsman friend told me, but I knew that at that point, you know, he didn't really mention the hangings. He just said we were going to hear something different.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very confused at that point.
You're right. As we filed out of the theater, I recalled the most shocking words spoken by Colonel Bumgarner. They had been slipped casually in amid his more outlandish statements. He referred several times to the detainees having killed themselves in their cells in Alpha Block. And so that's the part that you knew was categorically untrue.
Oh, absolutely. It was no way that no detainee died in their cells that evening. I had a guard on one end of Camp 1. I had five guards on the other end of Camp 1 with clear, unobstructed views of Camp 1 and the medical clinic. And there was no detainees at all transported from Camp 1 to the medical clinic that night. So I was absolutely certain that was not true at all.
And so, Joe, one of the issues that became very clear and presented a dilemma for you is that you were going to have to file reports, and that your reports would have to exclude the information about the now infamous white van and its movements on the night in question. And so you were going to have to sign off on the initial part of a cover-up.
Me and my men would file reports that, you know, of who they signed in, who they signed out that evening. My guard towers didn't see anything. We all told the story that we didn't see anyone transported from the Camp 1 to the medical facility. We didn't fend from that at all. There was no one transported, and we didn't report anyone transported.
And Joe, when I see you in that catch-22 situation, it brings to mind the, you know, bizarre World War II prison camp comedy show, Hogan's Heroes, and Sergeant Schultz, who famously said, "I see nothing, I see nothing." You remember him?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's disturbing. Definitely disturbing.
Yeah. So as the next few days evolved, you were suddenly given leave, and you went to what, to Baltimore to spend a little time away from Guantanamo?
Yes, yes.
And why did that happen?
Well, you were just given leave certain times of the year. My time was up to take leave, and I had a lot of questions, and I went home, and I really started questioning my mission there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just spent a lot of my time on that leave in the library and on the internet, really researching Guantanamo and seeing what I was a part of, really.
Yeah. And when you came back, did you feel different?
Well, I felt different. I felt different the day of the deaths when I saw on the news Admiral Harris saying three men committed suicides, hung themselves in their cells, and it was some sort of asymmetrical warfare. And I knew right then that this is a complete lie. This is some sort of cover up. And what am I doing here? What am I involved with?
And so, once you left Guantanamo, what did you want to do about this? Did you want to use channels to try to, explain what you knew and how it diverged from the story that had been offered to the public?
When my tour was up completely, I wanted to just forget Guantanamo. I didn't want to think about it anymore. I didn't want to remember it. And then I think it was May of that year I got back in 2007. There was another detainee death of suicide. And it just brought everything back. Was it really a suicide? I wasn't there. I don't know, but it just brought all those memories back. And I knew then that I couldn't drop this. I had to find out what happened on my watch, what happened when I was down there, and what was this place, what was really going on down there. So I knew I couldn't do it when the Bush administration was in office.
Mm-hmm.
And the next, during the elections, it was McCain and Obama, and I knew both were opposed to Guantanamo at the time, and I was anxious for them to take off, one of them to take office, and I was getting my ducks in a row on who I would approach about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I had several people I was looking at. There was a Mr. Ratner at CCR who was putting out very good reports and things like that.
That's Michael Ratner, who is now, I think, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. I've known Michael for 10 years. He is a really a solid guy and has been fighting very hard on these issues.
Yes, and he is absolutely brilliant and eloquent in getting the point across. And he really was my first inspiration on about Guantanamo and really figuring things out for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw Professor Mark Dembo's work at Seton Hall. And I like them in particular because the Center for Policy and Research only works with government documents and government official statements. That's what they gather all their information from, and they sift through thousands of documents and try to put pieces together about certain issues, and Guantanamo is one of them. And they're all good attorneys, but I wanted to go to an attorney. I wanted to report this and try to see if I could get a real investigation on what happened that night, because the NCIS, I was waiting the whole time there for them to question me on what happened that night. I was in the perfect position. I had men in the perfect position to report that no one died in their cells that night. And none of us were ever questioned by NCIS. So I wanted to go to report this to some government official and see if they would look into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Professor Mark Dembo, and that's what we arranged to do.
Joe, there's a great deal of information in your book about how the Seton Hall team worked with you to really uncover a lot of evidence that has helped you write the book and provide support documentation for your theories about what you observed and about what actually occurred on June 9th in 2006. There's additional information toward the end of the book that I want to highlight because it parallels some of the coverage that I've done here in the past. And in particular, you discovered through one of the documents, an autopsy report, that the patient showed signs of methylquinone. And my friend, who I know you have talked to many times, reporter Jason Leopold, and psychologist Jeffrey Kay, published blockbuster stories based on this information about the use of methylquinone. Now, it's an anti-malarial treatment with known side effects, psychotic side effects, particularly when large doses are applied. And the document you uncovered shows us that we later learned that virtually every prisoner at Guantanamo was heavily dosed with this stuff and essentially spent their first month or more in a state of psychotic excitement or strangeness. That's not a very good medical term, but you know what I mean. And so this brings up the specter of human medical experimentation. And we know that you as a guard were not dosed with anything to prevent malaria, and that there's been no outbreak of malaria at Guantanamo. Nevertheless, every inmate was subjected to this required prescription drug injection when they arrived. Talk about that and the implications of it.
Well, I found the document in the autopsy reports of one of the three detainees. And the document showed they received five times the original dosage of this drug. And I didn't know what to make of it. I looked up the drug briefly, but I didn't know what to make of it, and I was concentrating on the investigation of the death. So I gave it to Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay, and they really just busted that story wide open. If you take into consideration that they're given every one of these detainees this drug, I never had the drug. There's never been a case of malaria in Guantanamo that I know of. The contractors coming into work in Guantanamo has never received this drug. And when you look at the medical record of the detainee that I found the autopsy report in, his first few days at Guantanamo, he was hallucinating terrible. And he was seeing things. It's all documented. And I remember now, back in 2007, you know, after in September when the high value detainees came through, I had to set up a transport for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to get to the medical clinic because he was having seizures and all kind of problems, which is another side effect of this drug, and it makes me wonder if they even gave it to the high-value detainees in 2006. But the thing is if you really think about the human experimentation part, you got to remember these detainees were how they arrived here. They arrived, they took a 17-hour flight. In that 17-hour flight, they were completely sensory deprived. They had gloves on their hands, they had goggles on, earmuffs over their ears. The sensory deprivation was key for 17 hours.
And they also administered drugs through an enema or a butt implant, if you will, and then diapered the individuals because they were not permitted to get up and use restrooms during these 17-hour flights.
And I think Jeffrey Kay even spoke more on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they arrive at Guantanamo. They're given this methylquinone within 24 hours of arrival. They're given this drug that five times the dosage, which is going to cause serious hallucinations. It's a fat-soluble drug, so it's going to stay in their system for 30 days. They're put in isolation immediately. They're not allowed to see anyone except their interrogator. They're not allowed a Red Cross visit. They're not allowed a visit from the chaplain. They're not allowed any reading material, including the Quran. So for the next 30 days after taking this drug and going through all that hell getting here, they have more to stand. And I think this drug makes them desperate to the point they want so much help, and the only one they see is their interrogator. it really makes them, they're trying to make these detainees dependent on this one person.
Mm-hmm. Well, Joe, this is, to me, a very stunning and dark revelation. And it brings us down to the level of Dr. Joseph Mengele and the ugly human experiments that were conducted in the Nazi death camps and the deaths that you have exposed in your book. Make Guantanamo a death camp. And we don't know exactly what caused the deaths of those individuals that night, but we know that the story concocted by Colonel Bumgarner, that they managed to stuff cloths down their throats, secure their hands, and then hang themselves, is not plausible in the least. And yet, this has been permitted to stand. Congress has failed to investigate. The courts have blocked any efforts to expose these crimes. And President Obama's call for obstruction of justice, there's no other way I can describe it, which is this cute phrase about looking forward and not backward, has permitted these crimes to stand uninvestigated and with a cover story that is a sick joke permitted to stand as, allegedly purportedly factual.
Yes, it's and liberty for justice for some, right?
Yeah.
And I think there's a few other things I'd like to make clear.
Please.
With this is I wasn't the only guard to report this, and I don't think I make it clear enough in my book. But when I went forward to the Justice Department to report that this did not happen the way the government's saying, these men did not die in their cells. There were seven other guards with me that came forward to make that statement to the Justice Department. And Congressman Delahunt was behind me, and Senator Feingold was also behind me trying to figure out what happened. He asked for several meetings with the Justice Department, Senator Feingold did, and they kept telling him that this situation is classified and they cannot talk about it. And then he lost the election, and he contacted me through his aide, and his aide told me that he had three regrets while he was in office as senator, and one of those regrets was not getting to the bottom of the story.
Wow. Amazing. Now, Joe, one of the things that I promised our listeners to circle back to is your exposure of what happened to Shocker Ammer that same night. And I think it's very significant, and you're the first to report this. So please tell our listeners.
Well, I found a document while we were doing the investigations, and it was an affidavit by Shocker Ammer through his attorney, and he was explaining things he went through on June 9th, 2006. And it was shocking where he was tortured the same night those three men died. And his torture was done in a way where they obstructed his airway. There was a lot of similarities to what happened to those three men, and it wasn't a coincidence that it was the same night. I'm certain of that. Shocker was in Camp 5, though. I wouldn't have seen him transported if he was transported. But for it to be Shocker, all four, that makes all four of the three that died and Shocker were repeated hunger strikers and hunger strike leaders. And I worry about Shocker because, honestly, I don't think Shocker's ever leaving Guantanamo. I hope I'm wrong. I know there's a big outcry for him right now, but I think he knows too many dirty secrets about Camp 5, which has always been shrouded in secrecy. He knows possibly what happened on the deaths that night. He's not, and Shocker's the kind of guy that's going to be outspoken when he leaves. I don't think they'll ever let him go.
Wow.
But like I said, I really hope I'm wrong.
Well, I hope you're wrong too, but I appreciate you sharing your candid thoughts because I mean, Andy Worthington is a friend and colleague. He and others at Reprieve have been leading this creative and remarkable campaign to win the release of Shockerammer. They forced Prime Minister Cameron, or at least shamed him, into bringing it up with Obama on his recent visit to the White House. Obama made noises about, we'll make it a high priority, but he didn't make a commitment. And what you're explaining is, unfortunately, what I have theorized all along. And that is that Shocker has been a prisoner leader and helped others, and that he knows too much. And we have a pattern of those who have been told, you don't need a lawyer because you're never going to be charged, you're never going to be tried, and you're never going to be released. And I fear that Shocker falls into that unfortunate category.
I am very worried about Shocker. I think one of the reasons he did not die that night was because he has a British residence. The other three were practically nobody. He has a very powerful organization, Reprieve, fighting for him. He's too high profile to just get rid of like the other three were. And I really worry about Shocker and his safety. I don't think he's ever leaving Guantanamo.
Joe, the last thing, and there is much more in your book, but the last thing I would like you to talk about is how you describe the tensions between the two command groups, JTF-160 and JTF-170. And essentially, you know, to kind of blow through the jargon and the bureaucratic stuff, JT-160 was the original command group, and JTF-170 squeezed out 160. Explain the difference between these two entities and what the dominance of 170 essentially turned Guantanamo into.
Well, JTF-160 was the group that was in charge of detention operations at Guantanamo. At the same time, you had JTF-170 that was in charge of interrogations at Guantanamo. Both were supposed to be working together. One had a general. General Backus was in charge of JTF-160, and General Dunleavy was in charge of JTF-170. General Backus was a career military police general. He knew the Geneva Convention like the back of his hand. He knew how detainees were supposed to be treated and not treated. He was very firm, but he was fair. He knew what had to be done. General Dunleavy was in charge of interrogations. Backus, them two collided on philosophy right away because Backus wanted to make sure the detainees got their fed by their religious diet. He wanted to make sure they were able to pray during their prayer times. He actually at one point posted and give out documents showing what rights the detainees had. This infuriated General Dunleavy. He did not want detainees to know their rights or to be treated as he wanted to set everything on how the detainees would be treated. He wanted to soften them for interrogations, and Backus would not allow that.
And can I just insert a characterization here that what you've described is that Backus wanted to run an honest prison camp, and that Dunleavy, and he was succeeded by Jeffrey Miller, they wanted to run a concentration camp.
They wanted to run it led off of interrogations, yes. It was something completely new, and it was something that just should not have been. But in the end, Dunleavy outranked General Backus. He was a two-star general. Backus was one-star general. And Backus was relieved of duty. And after that, they merged the two. They merged the two commands together to JTF Gitmo. And the new general at JTF Gitmo was General Miller, that had no experience whatsoever in detention operations. And I think that was done by design. That way the interrogation group could run anything they want by this general and get him to approve it, because he has no idea what he knows nothing about detention operations. He was an artillery officer.
Hmm.
So,
and
that
I'll
was the
I'll
start
just...
of it. And since General Miller, there has been 11 commanders, and not one has had detention operation experience to this day.
Fascinating.
Not one general has any experience in detention operations.
And Joe, I'll just remind our listeners that Jeffrey with a G, Jeffrey Miller, was the general who was dispatched to Abu Ghraib to, quote, Gitmoize the interrogation and torture of prisoners at that notorious detention center outside of Baghdad.
Yes, he also is the one that called one of the two generals, Dunleavy and him, called Guantanamo America's battle lab. They were quoted as saying, calling it a battle lab. We know that General Dunleavy got his marching orders from the president, as he quoted in a statement, he was to report to Rumsfeld once a week in person on how things were going. Rumsfeld didn't want to know what was being done or how it was being done. He just wanted to know the results.
And so, Joe, what does America's Battle Lab mean to you?
Guantanamo was set up as America's Battle Lab to test interrogation techniques, to see what worked, what they thought worked, and what didn't work. Enhanced interrogation techniques, some of them brutal, and to apply them to other bases and other military units around the world. And that's what we saw in Abu Ghraib. All these things came from Guantanamo. Guantanamo is the testing ground.
And so, Joe, as we wrap up, how has this changed your life?
Well, it's after Guantanamo, well, during Guantanamo, it was the first time I ever questioned I took an oath as a soldier to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. I see men in 6x8 cells living there for years. Am I supporting and defending the Constitution when I see this? I was in an inner struggle with myself, and still am. I didn't perform an honorable duty there. And it was the first time that I ever questioned my authorities as a soldier. And you end up in a really dangerous place when soldiers have to question their authorities. And I think that's where we are right now, and it's a pretty scary world.
And Joe, have you faced any retaliation for your efforts to expose the truth up to and including the publication of your new book?
I have my loyal critics out there. But when I first came forward, they said they said I was doing this for personal gain, which is completely not true. They said I was shopping my story. But the biggest thing they said was I was a perimeter guard and I couldn't see anything that was happening that night. And that's not true. I worked a perimeter, but I worked a lot of at least 50% of my time or more was spent inside the camp with the detainees. I wish I was a perimeter guard during that riot. But I think I've had some retaliation, but since the book's been published, it's actually been the opposite. I have had so many soldiers and sailors contact me thanking me for writing the book. I have dozens of emails of people from when I was there and times after and times before thanking me for exposing what Guantanamo is. So I'm very happy. I thought I'd get much more than I would, but I'm very happy that it actually turned out to be a positive response from my peers, and that's what mattered to me.
And Joe, how do you respond? I'm trying to summon his name. He's a new senator, I think, from Arkansas. I think his name is Cotton. And he publicly stated last week that a couple of weeks ago, that he wants to keep Guantanamo open and that he wants to put more people there. And he had other characterizations that I can't quote right now. But, there's so many people in powerful positions who have access to the truth, whether it's from your book or from classified information. And yet they cling to this ridiculous idea that Guantanamo helps keep Americans safe. In fact, It is an irritant that drives many of the young jihadis who are ready to take up arms against the U.S. and its allies.
Well, the senator has, Senator Cotton has, you know, he's a veteran. He has a good military record. But he's never been to Guantanamo. And I think he's really ignorant on the subject as far as knowing who we have there and who we don't have there. But I would just challenge him. Spend a night in the tower the same way I did and watch over them people for one night. I guarantee you half of these people couldn't stand it. They wouldn't be able to handle it.
Well, Joe, you have my enduring respect and admiration. I really appreciate that you have almost obsessively worked to expose this story. And I think that I hope it has been helpful to you personally to, you know, overcome the baggage that you carry as a result. But even more significant, I feel you've done a major service to our nation. And I hope that someday we'll be able to look back and see that this chapter has been closed and that one of the reasons was that a courageous guy named Joseph Hickman stood up and told the truth.
Well, thank you. It has been therapeutic, actually, to write the book. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate your comments.
Joe Hickman, thanks for joining us today on the Peter B. Collins podcast.
Thank you.
You just heard a real American hero. I welcome your comments and feedback, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.